They slept well and secure that night, and awoke to a brilliant sunrise tinted orange. They held each other in their sleeping bags, then rose, packed their trail gear, and headed on. The going was rougher after a few hours. The tangle of brush yielded less and less to their machetes, and the slope became steeper. Roxanne tried to get a compass reading, but the needle squiggled around in its casing, as if searching madly for true north. Magnetic interference. He squinted in the direction they were going and saw what looked like an impassable butte ahead, a sheer rock wall of perhaps 4,000 feet, and took out the Schecter light binoculars. He swung the lenses slowly in a half circle and saw a way to breach the mountainside, a way for the pack horses to easily move on. And he saw something else as he peered through the binoculars. Grizzlies, the prize they had come for. They were out there, tearing about, a group of 10 or 12 at least in the next verdant valley. Rock watched them frolic through his binoculars, if tearing apart trees was frolicking. They clawed away at rotting trunks, literally tearing the wood apart, growling, sticking their long tongues into the cracks in pursuit of a snack.
What do you see?
Take a look.
Cute. Is it true that they surround you and hunt in a group when they get wind of you? Are they that smart?
Yeah. Look for a tall tree or it's people meet for them this evening.
They moved across the rise into the next valley and their rendezvous with enough bear meat to last weeks. The wind was still with them as they headed down the tree-lined slope into the thickly wooded valley. He'd have to remember the place for future hunts. He knew he would remember the peak towering behind them with its sharp twin boulders capping the very top. Silently, they tied the horses to some trees, slid their scoped rifles from their mounts, and moccasin-clad, moved silently onward to their prey. The bears seemed unusually tall. Two or three of them had looked over 12 feet. Rona walked alongside him silently, about 3 feet to his left. They moved as quietly as a slow breeze, their safeties off, fingers on the trigger guard. They were careful where they pointed the liberators, for the rifles had hair triggers. They entered the deep, dark forest ahead, a forest fairly easy to walk through, the trees being only lightly vegetated until about 10 feet up, where they became a wild tangle of vine branches. It was so dark underneath that they didn't see the lumbering black shadows closing in. Roxanne's liberator rifle flew out of his hands, slamming against a tree with such force that the barrel bent in half and the yoke stock smashed into little chunks of useless wood. There were three of them, and their red eyes seemed to glow in the semi-darkness.
Yeah.
Rona rolled to the side and came up, liberator in hand. At the same time, Rock scrambled back to his feet, giving himself a 10-foot separation between him and the bear, and whipped out his shotgun pistol. But both bears and the third, moving from behind an uprooted tree, kept advancing. Rock saw Rona sprint for cover just as the bear closest to her lunged. She ran about 20 feet to two large boulders side by side, with an opening at the base just big enough to hide a body. She dove into the opening, pulling her legs quickly in behind as the bear ran toward the rock, covering the distance in seconds. Rock slammed the rapid-fire shotgun pistol on auto. Blood poured out, but it didn't stop the bear. The grizzly slashed at the boulders, reaching frantically under to get to Rona. From 40 feet away, Rock watched. Rona was safe, but he had company. The two other grizzlies closed in on their human prey. They tried to surround him as they broke apart and came up from each side. They were trying to flank him. He had two shots left in the pistol and no time to reload. Suddenly, he remembered his phosphorus bomb.
Come on, you hairy bastards!
Roxon ran to the left, not looking back. The bomb showered them with burning phosphorus, burning into their thick hides. Their eyes were blinded from the light, brilliant as a sun. Roxon turned around and carefully walked to within 2 feet of one and pulled the trigger. Rock spun instantly around, one shot left. The phosphorus bomb had done its job. The other bear was burning, its thick red and black spotted pelt flaring with blue flames. No longer interested in the fight, it tore off into the woods, an action that only fanned the flames hotter. It would be dead within minutes. Rock turned and ran over to the boulder Rona had hidden beneath. A car-sized mass of fur and blood lay on the red ground, nearly blocking the narrow rock entrance. Rona had filled her unwanted guest with lead from inside her protective crevasse. He saw a hand coming out from under the huge rocks, trying to push at the bear's wide-open, motionless snout.
Come on, Rock! For God's sake, help me out of here!
Rock walked up to the huge black grizzly and grabbed hold of two thick handfuls of hide on the creature's neck. He pulled with all his strength, moving the giant inch by agonizing inch. Finally, after a minute of pulling at the creature again and again in red-faced bursts of strength, Rock at last cleared the opening enough for Rona to emerge. She dusted herself off and looked up at Rock, who couldn't help but smirk at her emergence from, literally, out of the bear's jaws.
Thanks. Whew, check out the thing's teeth. I've never seen anything like it.
In front of the grizzly's arm-sized jaw, there were two curved fangs, a good 12 inches long. There were rows of white pointed teeth disappearing in trails down the creature's throat.
Mutant. These fangs could be more adaptation taking place. Schechter's gonna go mad with joy when he gets this monster's...
What?
Shh! Rona, stay here.
Roxon hitched himself up the branches of a tall pine. He could barely make them out at first through the veils of leaves and branches ahead, but about 100 yards away was another group of grizzlies. No wonder no one had ever told him about this lush valley. No one had ever returned alive from it. The bears were almost running toward the clearing where the three grizzly corpses lay. Roxon reloaded his shotgun pistol with 8 shots.
Rona, hand me the .30-08. Get back into the crevice. I'll pick them off from here.
Oh, the hell I will.
She grabbed her fallen liberator and climbed up the tree, quickly joining Rock about 15 feet off the ground in the thick lower branches of the towering pine. 4 grizzlies burst into the clearing, each as wide in girth as the trees Rock and Rona hid in.
Fire!
Roxon brought his .30-08 to bear.
Holy shit! Did you...
Yeah, I packed the explosive shell. Hope you didn't mind.
Suddenly, a grizzly launched itself out from behind them, swinging a mighty paw up into the air like a sword. The claws, reaching 5 feet beyond its 11-foot shoulders, caught the branch upon which Rona was hanging. The bear turned toward the human that flew down to it, its jaws opening wide for the kill. Roxon had no choice. Throwing the hunting rifle away, he reached for his 12-gauge pistol, grabbed it in his right hand, and jumped. He landed full on the immense grizzly's back. He gripped a handful of thick matted fur and held the muzzle of the pistol at the creature's cranium. The 2-inch thick skull shattered into a storm of razor-sharp bone shrapnel. Yet, somehow, something lived within the grizzly monster. It reached up with its left claw and slashed at Roxon. Without a moment's hesitation, he got back up, reaching down for the bowie knife strapped to his leg. The grizzly took 2 steps forward before seeming to waver for a moment. Ignoring his wound, he walked quickly over to Rona, who was sitting up, rubbing her shoulder. Her silky red hair fell down over her face and neck, almost covering her. She tossed her hair aside and looked up at Roxon.
I landed all right, but then the damn branch came down on my back.
Well, we both got our wounds from this one. Our last little teddy bear hugged me a real sweet goodnight before the lights went out on him.
Oh, Rock, you're really hurt.
It'll heal.
Sit down.
The bear's claws had entered at mid-thigh, on the very outside of the leg, and pulled down a good 8 inches of flesh before losing contact. His khaki field pants were torn into 5 separate pieces where the claws had cut them like tailor's scissors. Rock pulled out a strap from a back pocket of the utility belt and tied a tourniquet at the very top of his leg.
That'll hold for 20 minutes or so until we get back to the hybrids where I can patch it up.
They stood next to each other and looked around at the scene of carnage. All around the clearing were pools of blood and furry flesh. the huge carcasses still twitched in death spasms.
Brock?
Just making sure.
That night, they lay together in their joined sleeping bags. Overhead, the Aurora Borealis rippled with writhing currents of rainbow electricity. Rona held him close to her, covering his body with hers, draping her arms and legs over his hard flesh. She nuzzled in his neck, and he slowly stroked her waist-long, soft, red hair.
Tell me about the old America, Rock. What was it really like? I know you study the old history tapes. Was it as great as they say?
Yeah, America was great, Rona. Great and powerful. And polluted and corrupt. The pursuit of money took precedence over the Founding Fathers' idea of freedom. The pursuit of the buck, they called it. You should view the tapes someday, Rona. See what they were willing to do to get money. Freedom came to mean license to do as you wished, as long as you had money. The citizens of America were mired in the same materialist obsession that the Russians are in now. And just like they fell, the Russians will someday fall. The old America died because it became too soft and complacent and lost its will to live. Now it's the Russians who live off the land, the slave labor of others, and become soft, while the free fighters become tougher and leaner every day.
But Rock, isn't that heresy? I mean, what you say about the old America?
Truth is never heresy. America was great for 200 years. Then it abandoned its ideals and pursued goals that weren't brave, weren't concerned with peace for the world. It didn't keep the torch of freedom burning. And that torch went out in an instant.
So we're trying to rebuild something that's not worth it?
No, Rona. We're trying to restore the dream the way the people back there failed to do. The original dream. Someday we'll fight the Russians off our backs, out of our land, and then we'll spread freedom to them. We won't occupy Russia permanently like they've done to us. America spreads liberty, doesn't take prisoners. Rona, once the United States had another great war. They called it World War II. And America and her allies conquered the whole world. But it didn't subjugate its enemies. It helped them rise again and rebuild the ashes of their society into democracies. That is what we must do.
But we hate the Russians.
Yes, but we must hate them for what they do, not what they are.
Kilov sat dead center in the most sophisticated technological room in the world, except for the satellite control complex in Moscow. That room represented the absolute refinement of the technology that had defeated America 100 years ago, kept constantly up to date. But Kilov had stolen and copied many of the satellite complex's technological secrets for his own room. The red LED light came on, and the screen lit up with a full-color map of the world, 40 feet wide. In the dark of the room, blue icons marked all known air activity, the ground positions of Russian forces, and the locations of all Russian warships and subs in the world. He had tapped into the satellite information being transmitted back to central control in Moscow. The Premier, if he knew of this, would have Kilov executed. But he didn't know, and he wouldn't until the time was right for Kilov to make his move. The KGB commander watched the icons as they shifted slowly about the flat globe of the Earth. The map zoomed until it was just the United States. Again, all red forces were shown in their occupying positions across the country. He fed some information into the computer that operated the map. The coordinates of his latest guesswork, aided by information supplied by troop patrols on sightings of rebel forces as to just where Century City was. He entered the data, added any pertinent information that had gathered from Westport, and had the computer calculate.
Where is the most probable location of Century City?
A blue dot appeared in the nearby mountains. Kilov leaned forward, practically salivating. Then, another blue dot lit up. Then another, and another. He sat back in disgust. The whole Rocky Mountain range was filled with blue dots, with more appearing by the second. Mikhail Vasily was not a big man. He was old, and that did not bode well for his continued reign over the vast Soviet Empire. But he was good at playing one group against another in the Politburo and presenting himself as the perfect compromise between all the warring factions. He was 71 years old, a good age for this new world. His mind was as sharp and precise as ever. It was just his body that was slowly failing, the legs trembling as he walked, the dark spots showing up with increased regularity on his body, precursors of cancerous conditions, as his doctors politely put it. Still, not many men reach the age of 70 anymore, not with all the poison in the environment. He stood at a window in the Presidium building, the highest and newest structure in the crumbling red brick fortress walls of the ancient Kremlin. He could look down at Red Square from here and at the endless lines of tourists from all over the empire, shivering in the 2 feet of snow as they waited hours to enter the hallowed halls of the Lenin tomb, the tomb that contained both the body of the great founder of the Soviet Union and the body of that heinous criminal, Premier Drubkin, who had unleashed the hell of thermonuclear war upon the planet Earth 100 years ago. Premier Vasily was one of the very few in Russia or in the world who had seen the original accounts of that wretched war. How the Russians had not been spared nearly as much as the authorities pretended. Nearly 25 of the United States' big boys, more than 10 megatons, had struck major cities throughout the Soviet Union, killing at least 30 million in the first hour and double that amount over the next few months. And by luck or accident, 4 of the American missiles had landed right in the center of the USSR's wheat-growing region, knocking out a good 80% of the arable land. He watched the snow fall in July. The world was in trouble. His empire was in trouble. He had gone through the folders of reports on his desk just before he took off his thick reading glasses and walked to the window. The reports had spoken of failing crops, rising resistance in the Indian subcontinent, and the resurgence of Buddhism in Southeast Asia. None of them had disturbed him as much as the one from America. Kilov had dropped 2 neutron bombs on some rebel outpost in the Rocky Mountains. The one thing he had asked his military commanders around the world was not to use atomic weapons. The world was on the brink of death as it was.
But what is to be done? I can't recall Kilov. He's too dangerous to have around. I can't have him killed and risk a power struggle. And I can't send Zhabnov to take care of it. That man's proved a disappointment. There's only one thing I can do.
Yes, Premier.
Rahala, take a letter, super confidential, all that, to Colonel Kilov, titles, medals, fill it in like you always do. Dear friend and comrade in arms, I read with interest a report that you have acted against the American resistance forces with a pair of small-yield neutron bombs. I know that you did this in the spirit of my directive not to damage the environment, and I trust that the natural damage has been kept to a minimum. I applaud your initiative and keen analysis of my attitude toward the use of nuclears. That policy is to restrain use unless the gravest of provocations has occurred. Please send details of provocation that led to the use of N-weapons. Paragraph. Your long-standing request to use N-weapons has been studied and approved in principle. However, any further judicious use of radiation-enhanced devices should be preceded by a statement from you as to the necessity for such measures. 10. No. Make that 8 small-yield neutron bombs can be used at your discretion if you adhere to these guidelines. Hoping you and your comrades are well, I remain. Finish it up, please.
Yes, sir. I will send it right away.
Yes, thank you.
Vasily took a book down from the shelf, Notes from the Underground by Dostoevsky, and began reading where he had left off.
It was still night, and the snow was coming down in masses and falling almost perpendicularly, blanketing the pavement and the empty streets as though with a pillow. There was no one in this street, no sound to be heard. The street lamps gave a disconsolate and useless glimmer. I ran 200 paces to the intersection and stopped short. Where had she gone? And why was I running after her? Why? To fall down before her. To sob with remorse.
But before long, the aging ruler of the world dozed off, his head falling back on the shadowed pillow. The snow outside grew more intense. Little dunes were forming in Red Square. The radiation level warnings were going up in Murmansk. The Sikhs were rioting in India in 120-degree temperatures. In South China, a warlord was preparing his 13,000 horsemen, fanatical Muslim followers of the Mu'abir, the flame of Allah. In Rangoon, Buddhist monks burned themselves to protest the new religious limitations and the machine gunning of 100 of their number just the day before. And in the Kremlin, in the breasted snow of Russia, the leader of the empire, the supreme premier of all the Russias, a tired old man, slept with his face pressed into the yellowing paper of Dostoevsky, page 345.